Scott Newman, and you're listening to 27 Rouge. For many of you, Coleman Hughes needs no introduction. But for those who aren't familiar, he's a writer, podcaster, thinker, and idea sharer who got his start writing for Quillette, a magazine I used to edit and where I remain a contributing editor. He's got bylines in the Times, the Journal, the Specky, and the Natty Review, and now he's even got a rap career. It was my distinct pleasure to sit down with Coleman in New York and get into it. Happy listening. Coleman Hughes, thanks for coming on to 27 Rouge.
My pleasure.
All right, let's start off with just some basic background here. Who is Coleman?
Who is Coleman? Coleman is a kid that was born in New Jersey. He's been living in New York since he was 18, who loves music, philosophy, writing, and the arts.
I see you dropped a rap album yesterday.
I did. It's called Amor Fati, F-A-T-I, which is a Latin phrase that means love of fate. And you can listen to it in fine music distribution stores everywhere.
I did listen to some of it on the subway here. It was quite good. I especially like 25, and I'll ask you about it. But I'm just curious now. I know you also have a background as a jazz musician. You play the trombone.
I do, yeah.
So how do you see rap and jazz as distinct, or how have the two sort of, did your former career as a jazz musician, former experience as a jazz musician inform your rap, or how do you see the relationship between the two?
They're very similar genres for many reasons. One, they both come from Black American culture. They both prize improvisation. Mm-hmm. Or as you would call it in rap, freestyling. But unlike European classical music and other art forms where there's no tradition of improvising, in jazz there's always been a strong, almost the point is to show your unique voice and what makes you different and improvise, do something on the spot. Hip hop took that as well from jazz. And then I think thirdly, they both were first considered gutter music, and then
what is later, gutter? What does that mean?
Like the music of low society.
Yeah.
And then only later in their life became considered music, like true high art. Mm. So jazz was very much considered gutter music in the 30s and 40s. And now it's like at Lincoln Center, and you can get a degree at Juilliard in jazz, which I almost did. And same with hip hop. Obviously, it was like considered gutter music. And now you can be Kendrick Lamar and win a Pulitzer Prize. So they're very similar genres for all those reasons. And so it's pretty natural. I feel it was pretty natural progression for me to go from jazz to hip hop, because not only are they similar in all those ways, they're actually just similar in the music itself. Like a lot of what hip hop producers sample are jazz records. Definitely a synergy and a connection between the two.
The obvious difference being is that one is vocally focused and you can't sing while you're playing the trombone, right?
You actually can. It's called multiphonics.
What?
Yeah. You look
with what you play with, like half your mouth.
You buzz your lips and hum your vocal cords at the same time.
That's wild.
And there's some people are cool. I can sort of do it, but some people are really great at it and they get really funky sounds. Look it up on YouTube.
Yeah. I will.
Yeah.
Dude, that's awesome. I played a little bit of guitar when I was a kid, not very well. Mm-hmm. But I could never sing. Not that I had any voice of which to be proud, but I could never sing and play at the same time. I couldn't multitask like that.
Oh yeah. Like one has to be automatic, or they both have to be automatic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't sing and play guitar. I mean, I can barely play guitar, but I could probably sing and play piano, because piano's pretty automatic.
I'm not a musically gifted person.
That's okay.
No, it's, I have such great respect for musicians. I've had some on this show, and I have friends who are musicians, just because there's a certain magic to it for me, because I know I could never do that. I'm sure, if I trained every day and, you work hard and persevere, you can learn anything. But in the way that like writing has sort of, not always, but for a long time has just made sense to me. And for example, calculus never did.
Right.
looking at music, trying to read music, I couldn't do it.
Well, everyone has their natural strengths and weaknesses. And I think it, you know, people do want to say, oh, you can become good at anything if you try hard enough. And it's like, maybe, but we're all starting from such different places in terms of our natural talents that in many ways it makes sense to pursue what you are naturally good at. Like, but you know, you should try everything, but at the end of the day, you don't want to be hammering against a closed door. Like, I don't know that I could be a visual artist. I was just always terrible at visual art. Maybe if I did my 10,000 hours, my Gladwell hours, I'd be like good, but I'm not sure I'd ever be great.
Yeah. I mean, sure. I think at some point people might reach the tipping point, but first of all, like, why would you want to? I mean, I think identifying your natural proclivities and understanding that we all have our own sets of advantages and disadvantages, and then working from there is not a bad thing. I chose not to be a dancer or a visual artist or a musician. In the same way that, you know, I have friends who, I have a friend doing an economics PhD right now. And another friend doing a French literature PhD. And I know, like, I wouldn't want to do that. So some people, I think, get into this thing where they're either trying to prove to others or themselves or whatever, and they lead these sort of miserable lives where they just spend tens of thousands of hours doing something that they don't really like and they don't want to be doing. I think there's something to be said, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's music or skateboarding, whatever, if it makes sense to someone and they like it, pursue it. If it doesn't, like, you're under no obligation, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people do things for their parents. And in my case, I had a difficult situation, which had a silver lining though, which is my mom passed away when I was 18. So I learned, I think, a lot younger than some people that you can't live for your parents.
Yeah.
I think there are people that into their 20s and even 30s do things because their parents expect them to. And then, you know, either their parents die or they wake up one day realizing, shit, I've created this whole life for mom or for dad. And now they're gone and I just have to live it out.
Yeah.
And that's a very, I mean, I guess it was, it's better to have that, in a way, realize that as a young person than to create a whole life and have a midlife crisis where you realize you haven't been living for yourself.
It's an interesting point. I'm sorry to hear that, by the way, man. My mom passed away when I was 13. So something similar.
Yeah.
I think for me, it instilled a certain understanding that life is fleeting and ephemeral and very much finite. I saw a lot of death at a young age, family members, people I, you know, second or third degree relations to, friends of friends, young people too. And I don't know if you could call me calloused or whatever, but I almost developed a desensitivity to it, or I just realized, like, all right, the game, you know, life is an infinite game, of course, and you should invest in yourself and go to the gym and whatever, do these things that will produce dividends. But at the end of the day, this, you know, we're all living on borrowed time, where this is a finite set of circumstances. So to that end, why not pursue what you really want to do? I mean, there are very good, you know, if one of the things I first started writing about was a lot of kids I went to school with, I went to Princeton undergrad, end up just running off into investment banking and consulting and, you know, in tech and careers that they don't really want to do. And I'm sure you have thoughts about that. We don't have to get too far into it, but I was sort of baffled. It's like, here we have some of the most privileged people on the planet who could do anything. just sort of regressing into a very narrow set of professions. And my attitude is like, why would you do this? Now, there are good reasons, of course. Your mom is sick. You need to pay for her surgery. You go and you be an investment banker. You make six figures in the first year. Social mobility goes up much more quickly than it ever has. Well, not necessarily ever, but then at other points in American history, the ability to go that far up that quickly in a matter of like 1 year after graduation mm-hmm. is remarkable. So I don't want to say there's no reason to, there are reasons to pursue paths that you're not like in love with. But when you realize that like life is short, my attitude is most of the time for most people, it's like, why not do what you're passionate about? What, you know?
Well, I'm picturing a person that basically their goal is, I want to make money. I'm not really passionate about anything specific, and I'm certainly not passionate about anything that I'm great at. So like, let's say you're a guy that basically your hobbies are like hanging out with your friends and playing video games.
Sure.
But you're not by any means in the top 1% of Call of Duty players in the world.
Yeah.
And you have no real strong other passions.
Mm-hmm.
Why not get a finance job? Because you can just make bank and then in your free time, do fun shit with your friends and family. Because I think there are some people for whom work is not going to be their main source of meaning and pleasure in life.
Yeah.
And then there are other people like me. I've always been, since I was as young as I could remember, really passionate about doing specific things.
Yeah.
And I have got good enough at those things, say writing or music, that I could realistically make a career of it. But if that wasn't the case, and I know people like this, if you're just like, look, I want to make as much money in as little time as possible using skill sets that I have, and it's not my passion. And if you gave me $1 billion to retire today, I would. So I'm going to go into a high paying profession and just, you know, go on some killer vacations in my free time.
Yeah. You know, one thing I found living in Australia was that people are very much not defined by their career over there.
Mm.
Not to generalize, you know, it's a big country.
Right.
But I didn't know what some of my friends did for work. Like I had a vague idea, like maybe this guy works in marketing or this guy does something in front, you know, at a desk. But it's very much not, it was not the same as it was in America, where like you're sort of in some ways defined by your career, at least certain people. So to your point, someone just gave me a book, actually, or I found the book in my room. I don't remember exactly where it came from. It's called Designing Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget who wrote it. I forget what the background is. I don't know if they were like a UX designer or an interior designer or something, but they basically then extrapolated this into your life. And there certainly are people, as you've just alluded to, who you think about life design and they're like, okay, I want to hang out with my friends and play video games and go on vacations. What do I need in order to do that, to sustain those activities? I need bank.
Right.
I get a job in finance.
Right.
So it's about like whole life. There are different ways of designing your life. Some people get this intrinsic value from work, and some people get their meaning and whatever from other stuff. I found that in Australia. People just work is work and life is life.
Right.
I don't live that way, but some people do, you know?
Well, America is it's a special kind of country in that almost everyone who is here, for the most part, people's ancestors at some point came here to make a career. That's pretty much why. I mean, I guess obviously the pilgrims came for religious reasons and the slaves were taken here.
Yeah.
But everyone else, which is the majority of people, immigrated here in order to make careers and to make something of themselves. So the set of people that have come here, like in a way, a self-selected set of people that have come here to be ambitious. And maybe that creates a different culture from other countries where that's not the case.
Yeah. All right. First of all, I think that's an excellent point. And I think that that sort of careerism is maybe not distinctly, but certainly characteristic of the American identity, or it's baked into the cake.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I want to pivot a little bit. There's a lot we could talk about here. We'll get into a juicy question now. I probably shouldn't even discuss this so we didn't get shadow banned or whatever from Spotify. Okay. But are you familiar with Andrew Tate?
A little bit. So I don't know how the algorithm is working nowadays, because usually I'm super clued in and tapped into like contrarian people that are thinkers that are becoming famous. But I basically was not aware of Andrew Tate at all until he got busted by Greta Thunberg in Eastern Europe for his human trafficking thing. So I completely missed his whole rise.
Yeah.
So I know a bit about him now, but I'm curious what you have to say or ask me about him.
I also missed a lot of the rise. I came across the guy, Zuby. He's a
rapper. I know Zuby. Yeah,
yeah. Good so guy. I had Zuby on the mm-hmm. podcast. I don't know, in May maybe. Mm-hmm. And then I saw that Zuby had interviewed him, mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, like I like Zuby. Mm-hmm. Let's see what this episode is. And it was a video podcast that was not available on Spotify, and it was only available on YouTube, which I found to be kind of curious. But I watched it and it was quite interesting. I was fascinated. I thought that he has some very bad points, but he's very good points, but I'm not really interested in the content of what Andrew Tate is saying. I'm more interested in his rise, in why, like how he was able to do it so quickly and why there was a market for this. Mm. So not to generalize, but I would, or not to speculate, but I would imagine that the vast majority of Andrew Tate's audience are men, young men, teenagers,
yeah.
You know, maybe like 15 to 25, 15 yeah. to 30, something like that.
Yeah.
And there's a huge market to like tap into these dudes who sort of feel like down and out, or maybe aren't the most secure, aren't the most confident. Jordan Peterson originally, I think, was very helpful to a lot of people, really helped a lot of people turn their lives around.
Yeah.
And Tate, I think, is another flavor maybe of the same kind of milkshake. You mm-hmm. know, Jordan now has gone and expanded into lots of different territories. But what is it? First of all, it's also transnational. It's not just in the US or just in Europe or just in, you know, this guy had fans fucking all over the place. What is it about the condition of, in your opinion, Coleman, of 15 to 25 year old men that why are they perhaps, obviously they're impressionable, but why are they like this target audience that maybe Tate was able to tap into?
So my guess, and I'm shooting from the hip because I haven't actually consumed any Andrew Tate content, my guess is that a lot of men in modern Western societies have a lot of what they've heard from the culture, from television, from elite institutions, from their teachers at school and their school assemblies. A lot of the message they've heard in general is heavily feminist, in the sense that the basic idea is, in order to be a good man, you have to be very nice to women and you have to treat women equally. And that's the thrust of the message.
That's not a bad thing. All right.
It's not a bad thing. It's also a very incomplete understanding of gender and sexual attraction and the psychology of that and what actually works in the real world. So I think because that has been pushed, that button has been pushed so hard, when someone like Jordan Peterson, and I can speak more to JP because I've consumed him, comes along and says, well, look, actually, this is what women actually want. They don't want what you heard at your Women's History Month school assembly. They actually want a guy that's more like aggressive or blah, blah, blah. And maybe there's a, because that aspect has been really suppressed, I think it allows market space for someone like this to come along and really push that message in a hard way. And people may find that appealing because they're not hearing it from anywhere else. And it seems taboo. When you make something taboo, it creates a huge market for it, a huge market need for it.
Absolutely. I totally agree. There's this like spotlight effect that happens when you try to hide something or say you can't talk about this.
Right.
And I think that's part of when Tate got banned from like every platform. It got banned from Instagram, Facebook. Mm-hmm. For a while, he was banned from Twitter. It just brought him more sort of cachet, fame, whatever.
Right.
When you try to ban something, it not always, but a lot of the time it has the opposite effect. This happened to degenerate art in Nazi Germany. I wrote about this before I was even aware of the culture wars and cancel culture and wokeism and whatnot. Hitler determined that a lot of, he called it degenerate art, that a lot of like modernist, cubist art was bad and degenerate and antithetical to the like the Übermensch. Mm-hmm. And he like plundered a lot of mainly Jewish art dealers' collections, Jewish people's homes, and he confiscated this degenerate art. And then he made a roving exhibition called the I forget, but it ran parallel to this thing called the Great German Art Exhibition, which was like statues of ripped dudes and such. And he paraded it around Germany with like graffiti on the walls and you know, the paintings like ripped out of their cases and such. Mm-hmm. And it brought a ton of attention to this degenerate art, and it became extremely prized. And the Nazis ended up realizing this and then selling a lot of it off in 1937 in Lucerne, Switzerland, and they raised a shitload of money for the war, for the war effort. And the idea is like, they tried to ban it. They tried to say it's bad. And then people were like, it brought it to a lot of other people's attention.
Right.
I think it's the same thing that happens to people. When you try to cancel someone, sometimes it has the opposite effect.
There's a phrase for that. They call it the Streisand effect. Because there was
As in Barbra Streisand,
yeah. Because there was a famous example where Barbra Streisand, someone took a picture of her house or something, the actual house she lived in, and publicized it. And she tried to get that censored. She tried to sue the person or somehow eliminate, you know, that. But her effort to get rid of it made it actually more publicized. Mm. So it completely backfired, and now everyone knew the address to her house. So people call it the Streisand effect when you try to get rid of something, censor something, and it ends up amplifying it.
Yeah. All right, we don't have that much time, so I want to shift gears if that's all right.
Yeah, let's do it.
And talk a little bit about one of the songs in your album, which is 25.
Yeah.
I'm turning 25 in
nice.
A month.
All right.
You're 26 now.
I'm 26, yeah.
26.
Yeah.
So you were 25 not so long ago. What is this song about, Coleman?
Well, I guess it's more about a feeling than about anything specific, but 25 is kind of a weird age because...
Quarter life crisis.
Yeah, you're like... In an earlier era, 25-year-olds would be married with kids and be full adults.
Are you married with kids, Coleman?
No.
Neither am I.
No kids that I know of. but nowadays, it's like 25 is considered by many to be too young to be married or have kids.
Yeah.
And you're still maybe on your parents' health insurance. And so it's a kind of an in-between age. Whereas 18 used to be kind of an in-between age, 25 is now an in-between age as adolescence gets extended. Basically, I feel like being in your young 20s is almost like being a teenager used to be.
Like, yeah.
You still aren't expected to have everything figured out. And yet you have a very much like an adult, completely adult body. And like, I'm already starting to lose my hair. Like my hairline is receding and I'm on Rogaine.
Like
I could still be on my dad's health insurance in theory.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a kind of paradox of getting older, but society still considers you like a baby in some ways.
Mm. It's, there's a certain elongation of adolescence for better or for worse. I mean, lifespans have also gone up.
Yeah, that too. That too.
So I think certainly that has something to do with it. And I have more questions about this, but I'm just curious. Why'd you shoot the video in London? Was there just because you were in London and you felt like it? Or is there a particular connection?
That, you nailed it.
It was a thing to do. You were there?
I was in London already. And I, at the last minute, I was like, wait, we should shoot some stuff.
Yeah, let's do it.
And then we ended up shooting a whole video. It was not planned at all. I just happened to be in London.
I was in London this summer quite a bit. I went in thinking I really wouldn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Still a bit upset about the... That's Andrew just screaming next door.
Is that Andrew Schultz screaming next door?
I probably... Yes.
The ground is literally shaking. They probably can't hear this right now, but the ground is shaking because I think Andrew Schultz is like slapping the ground next door.
It sounds like they're fighting.
Someone might be dead in there.
Or banging on the table.
That's insane.
It's, you know, if it wasn't him, I might be upset about it, but I
can't get mad at Andrew Schultz.
No, I happen to be a fan. Yeah. So I'm going to Argentina tomorrow for a month. And Andrew, on one of his latest podcasts, he was telling this hilarious story. He was at the Hermes store in Paris or something, trying to get a bag. And this Argentinian dude came out. And they were like, what's your name? And the guy's like, my name is Adolf. And Andrew was like, your name is Adolf? You're from Argentina? Like, it's not Adolfo? And the guy's like, it's Adolf. I'm German. I'm of German descent. And Andrew, I don't know. It was a bit dicey.
Yeah.
I'm Jewish. I still thought it was funny. There's a hilarious French movie, Coleman, called the Prénom, the first name,
mm-hmm.
About this couple wants to name their baby Adolf. It's very funny. Anyway, that's totally irrelevant. That's not in the questions. I heard the ground shaking, and you can't be mad about that.
No, you can't.
But no, look, on the subject of elongated adolescence, I actually got an email from my pediatrician today because I had requested my immunization history for, in case they ask for it in Argentina. And I said, can I still come in and see you? And he said, no, seeing as you're an adult, I will no longer see you. And I was like, but you saw me when I was, 23. I've been traveling for the last couple of years. At what point does adolescence cut off, literally and figuratively? I know guys who are like, and I'm sure you do too, who are like 30 and they still are sort of behave like 17, 18-year-olds.
Right.
And so I don't think it's an American phenomenon. I think it's definitely a global phenomenon, not everywhere, but certainly an American, European, Australian phenomenon.
Yeah.
And other cultures. I've, friends in Brazil, mostly, I don't know if it's gendered, but I've heard it from girls where they live with their parents until they like get married. Like that's a thing.
Yeah, that's a thing in other countries. I mean, I've heard that's a thing in like Italy. It's not weird to live with your parents until you're like 28.
Or even people, there's these multi-generational households.
Yeah.
They like want to take care of their parents.
Right.
Or the one set of parents moves in with you.
Right.
I don't know. I think it does come with some drawbacks of like overgrown children incapable of doing like basic life skills, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have strong opinions one way or another. I'm just thinking
I do think it comes with drawbacks. I think on the one hand, you want to have fun as long as possible and act as if you have no responsibilities, like you're a kid again. People want to extend that period as long as possible. Understandable. But at a certain point, Like, you have to wake up and be an adult. And I mean, I think this is probably one reason why the birth rate is declining almost everywhere on Earth, except for hyper religious communities like the Amish and Haredi.
Orthodox Jews.
Yeah. Everyone else, the birth rate each year is getting lower and lower, in part because people are just starting later and there's a biological clock, right? Like, if you start at 24, you have a long window to have children if you're a woman, right? If you start at 34, you have a shorter window. You have a window still, but you're probably going to get fewer in.
Yeah, sure.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing in any one person's case. In any one person's case, the right number of kids for you might be 0 or 1. So it might not matter. But on a societal level, like, we're actually not replacing ourselves. Our numbers, without immigration, our numbers would dwindle.
Mm.
And in places like Japan with no immigration, their numbers are dwindling. They're getting smaller.
They have the reverse pyramid thing going on.
Yeah, exactly. Every couple of two people is not having, on average, 2 kids.
Yeah.
Which seems like, I don't know, it seems like a problem.
You know, it is a problem. And I might be a selfish bastard for saying this, but I'll say it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care. Like, you and I are going to be just fine, Coleman.
Well, yeah, I guess.
Whether it's on a lot, like, I don't think we should, like.
What about if by the time we're 70, we might live in a society where the balance of old to young is so out of whack that they have to, like, put us to work as 80-year-olds because there's not enough, a big enough working population, right?
I plan to work past 80 anyway, but no. I know.
Like, hard physical labor?
No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know that I would envision such a scenario. There's a woman, I was going to have her on this podcast and then, I don't know, we couldn't schedule it. What's her name? She wrote this book called Future, Elise Bohan. She's at Oxford. She wrote this book called Future Superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
She's sort of like in the camp of, you know, this David Sinclair guy, he's at Harvard. He's like biohacking, like the elongating Brian Johnson and talks about this.
Mm-hmm.
And she's talking about, like, the future of humanity and how we're just, like, in these, like, meat sacks right now, but that's not forever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, fuck, in 50, 60 years, you know, I have no idea what Elon has this, what this is.
Neuralink? You
know, the flash drive in the head, Neuralink.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen when we're 80.
I mean, I don't know either. I somehow don't think that we'll have solved aging or death by then. I think you and I probably are going to age and die. We shouldn't expect otherwise.
I used to be real upset about this, the fact that I was going to age and die. And then I saw, of all things, this clip of, like, a jacked Brad Pitt playing some, like, Greek warrior or whatever, I think in Troy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And he goes, there's this speech. He goes, the gods envy us because we're mortal. It's because everything is finite, that life is made to be much more beautiful. And I think there's something to that. I think I realized that when my mom died, when I lost some other people along the way. I'm okay with the fact that I'm going to die. The aging thing, yeah, I guess that could present issues. It's not not the coolest to imagine a bunch of 80-year-old dudes, like, having a fucking.
But if you think about it, like, but when you were a child, before you knew death was a thing, life still felt pretty meaningful, right? At least in my memory.
Yeah, it did.
Right? So is it that the finiteness of life gives it meaning, or is it that we learn life is finite and find a way to continue having meaning? Because that's what people do. They find ways to be happy despite reality, you know?
Well, that's in your domain, brother. You studied philosophy.
No, but it's like, look, if tomorrow the New York Times headline dropped, they said, figured it out, no more death, immortality for everyone. I think we'd adjust. Like, we'd find ways to still make life meaningful in the new reality of immortality.
I would agree.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Humans are remarkable at adapting to new situations.
Yeah, they are.
You know?
They really are. That's an excellent point. I think we would find ways to make it work, make it meaningful, and to make it make sense.
Yeah.
Because there's no alternative.
That's what we do.
Yeah. That is what we do. And and it can go in very nasty and evil directions sometimes. Mm-hmm. Bad stuff is happening. And I don't know whether it's the Holocaust or whatever. And then people are just, you know, Hannah Arendt called it the banality of evil. We adapt to like some pretty shite circumstances.
Yep. And even in retrospect, make those meaningful, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We are resilient motherfuckers.
Yes, we are. We really are.
All right. I have a few more here in the last few minutes. This one relates to artist versus culture warrior. Mm-hmm. So to be frank, Coleman, I've grown somewhat apathetic. I've been at this less time than you. Mm. But even in, you know, my year having worked at Quillette, having gone to a lot of these events and cocktail parties and whatever, and met a lot of people in and around some of the, what some people would call the IDW circles.
Yeah.
I've developed a certain kind of apathy. Mm. And maybe that's, I don't know if it's right or wrong. It's just what's happened. So I don't care to like be fighting in the same way that, well, there's no need to name names, but in the same way that some people are like actively participating in activism, you know? Mm-hmm. I just don't care. I travel all the time. I live in hostels and sleep on couches and floors and all kinds of random places. And I meet really awesome people from all over the world. And a lot of them just don't know or care about some of the issues that if you lived on Twitter would just be front and center every day.
Yeah.
And so my question to you has to do with, and so my answer to this dilemma is I've decided to pursue maybe a career as an artist over a journalist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like art for the sake of art, not art underpinned by a political driver.
Right.
So my question to you is about artist versus culture warrior. Do you see your career in music as a podcaster in some degree, but mostly in music as a distinct silo, or how do you approach that dichotomy? Or maybe you don't see a dichotomy between artist, journalist, artist, culture warrior. Do you understand sort of what I'm getting at here?
Yeah, I guess I've never really viewed myself as a culture warrior. So like, what's the difference between someone with an opinion that's currently controversial and a culture warrior? It's hard to say, right? Because if you have an opinion that happens to be controversial at the moment and a part of the culture wars, then expressing yourself is going to come across as you're a culture warrior. Although I've never really seen myself that way. And like you, in my art, I generally value art before politics, not art because of politics. Just, you know, creating great art for its own sake is my goal, no doubt. And there is a toxic, exhausting quality to culture wars, like all wars. It brings out the worst in people on all sides. So it can very quickly get exhausting to participate in that if you are kind of a normal, well-adjusted person that wants to be happy, as opposed to someone that is sort of broken inside and therefore constantly looking for a battle. So at the end of the day, I want to strike some balance where if I have an opinion that I think matters to me and happens to be controversial, I can express it. I can wade into it if I feel that I have something of value to say, to contribute to a culture war topic. But I never want to feel like a warrior in the sense that my identity is caught up in me being on one side of this grand conflict in my head and needing to participate in every battle because I wouldn't know who I was if I didn't. As you say, this whole quote-unquote culture war is playing itself out on like Twitter, where 80% of, I think something like 80% of Americans aren't even on Twitter and don't even get started about the whole world. And most people on Twitter aren't even really looking at the tweets. It's really a battle between like 2% of people and another 2% of people. And if they just shut off their laptops, threw away their phones and went outside and like talked to someone, they'd realize, oh my God, like no one else is thinking about the stuff that I'm obsessing over all day. And and there is like a certain type of person that actually does not realize that Twitter is not real life. Like they talk to everyone.
Aware.
Yeah. Right. I'm sure you've met these people if you've been at the cocktail parties that,
I have.
Yeah. So it's like they're like clueless people that will like go up to a person on the subway and be like, oh, like have you been paying attention to this Brett Weinstein ivermectin? And they're like, what?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, nobody knows what that is. Yeah. Man. Like you're just online. You're too online.
Yeah.
So I definitely don't like the quality of being too online. That's something that is to me, can be a red flag about someone if they're too online.
Yeah.
On the other hand, some interesting things happen online and it's worth keeping a lookout out of the corner of your eye.
Absolutely. Look, I don't have a perfect answer to this. It's something I struggle with, my online presence.
Yeah. I
recently deleted all the apps from my phone. So I would just use Instagram, for example, on my computer.
Yeah.
I think interesting things do happen online. You see interesting things. Maybe you can meet interesting people. But to your point earlier, I've met people with hundreds of thousands, you know, millions of followers who in person are just like terrific weirdos. Like they're just like not socially adept.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It's not always a bad thing, like, but it sort of was rather surprising to me the first time it happened, and then it happens again and again, and you're like, oh, maybe there's something of a pattern here.
Right. No, it's not real life at all. And people aren't who they seem to be online quite often.
Yeah. All right, we have like 2 minutes. So
cool.
Just quick list here. Favorite films of Coleman Hughes?
Let's see. Favorite films, I would say Interstellar.
Great film.
Little Miss Sunshine. Django. That's a good list to start.
Favorite fiction books?
I don't really read fiction books.
Really?
No.
Do you have a favorite childhood book?
I liked Of Mice and Men. It affected me quite deeply, at the time.
Cool. Well, Coleman Hughes, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Scott.
Yeah, no worries, man.